My good friend Danny Durham, and I have a picture of him here, I think, died last week. He was 54 years old and one of the strongest, most fit, health-conscious individuals I ever knew. He was jogging on the campus of Harris County High School in Columbus, Georgia, something that he did every day. He served as the athletic director there. He suffered what is called sudden cardiac arrest, a catastrophic electrical malfunction in the heart that can strike otherwise healthy individuals. Jim Fix comes to mind. Some of you may know that name. The cases are somewhat different. Fix wrote the best-selling book, The Complete Book of Running, in 1977. And he is the person most responsible for popularizing jogging in this country. And a few years later, at 52, he died of a sudden heart attack while jogging. And the whole world said, how could this be? How could a man so fit, the very man who created this sport, die like this? And that was my reaction. That was our reaction when we learned of the news last weekend. This can't be right. It simply can't be true, but it was. His memorial service was held this past Sunday in Columbus. More than 2,000 people attended. And that's only a small fraction of the people his life touched. He was a two-time national champion playing linebacker for the Georgia Southern Eagles at 155 pounds. He coached high school football all over the state of Georgia, including my own alma mater, Gordon Central High School, in my hometown. Husband to Julie Griggs, father of three children, mentor to thousands of young students, one of the finest men of integrity I have ever had the opportunity to meet. And I had the privilege to say that I was once his pastor. It was 18 years ago I was pastor of the Trinity Baptist Church in Calhoun, Georgia. And Danny and Julie and their kids had moved to town and were part of my congregation. And at that time, I was in the deepest personal crisis of my life, going through a divorce and raising two kids and trying to lead this growing, sprawling, exploding congregation without losing my mind. And it was during this time that I learned through all of that, it's where I first learned to be a little more honest on Sunday mornings with what I was saying. Chuck Parker told me recently that he says, I like to poke the tiger. I love that, Chuck. Thank you. But what else can you do, really? Because the caged tiger is usually inside of me. And so you may feel like I'm poking the tiger. I'm usually after whatever is going on inside. And I learned to preach, not a sermon, but to talk to myself, to let out my doubts and my fears and my struggles and let it all hang out, because I've learned that if you do that, you realize, people realize, hey, we're not in this alone, we're in this together. That everybody really is sort of struggling and fighting with the same things, aren't we? So isn't it better just to be honest about that? And the last place we should be hiding, I mean, the church doesn't have to be perfect. But it has to be honest, right? It has to be honest. So when we get honest about our struggles and everything, it's good for all of us. And so I was doing that. I was just learning to do that. And you could see a distinct change in my sermons, I was told. And Danny came up to me after church one Sunday, and he put his arms around me, and he said, boy, I think you're going to preach your way through this. And I have never forgotten that. He did what a good coach does. Help you stay in the game. I have so many good memories of him. I was the team chaplain for his football team a number of years and went to all those summer camps, all those games with a bunch of stinking coaches and high school players. The last time we were together was years and years ago. Our whole families were together. They were down here on vacation, and we met them at what used to be O'Charlie's near Destin, and they had all their kids, and we had all of our kids, and we lingered there for hours. And the kids ate about 80 pounds of yeast rolls each. And when those rolls got cold and hard, they resorted to using them as games of dodgeball, dodge roll, over in the side of the dining room. And Danny got up, I thought, to correct them, and began coaching how best to do that. We wrecked the place. We wrecked the place. And I don't think I've ever left a larger tip to the servers who waited for us that night. They earned it. And I'll never forget Danny when we're getting ready to leave, goes and finds the restaurant's vacuum cleaner and begins cleaning up after us. But my greatest memory of Danny is the song you heard us sing today. You know, in most Baptist churches, there is a rotation of people who will sing the special. You know what I mean? The person that sings the solo or the special music. It's like that in most Protestant churches, I suppose. And in most churches, the rotation of soloists, shall we say, waxes and wanes in regard to talent. I'm not being mean, but you know what I mean. There's that rare soloist who is always perfect. There is the one who is always flat. There is the one who is always trying to sing a song two or three steps above where he or she should be singing. And then there is the one, and you know the one, who sings the same solo every time they're asked to sing. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Do you know these churches? Yeah. Well, Danny fell into that last category. He sang the same song every time. And not because he couldn't sing. He grew up the son of a minister of music, five boys, and Danny had pipes. What a great voice that he had. But he loved this song, A Man After Your Own Heart, written by Gary Chapman, who was once married to Amy Grant. And as a complete aside, those of us who came of age in Christian music in the 70s and 80s to this day are in love with Amy Grant. And don't you dare say a bad thing about her. Today she is married to Vince Gill, country legend. They are very happily married. Back in the day she was married to Gary Chapman, an accomplished writer and singer and performer in his own right. And this is one of his finest songs. Oh God, Father in heaven and earth, I call to you like deep calls to deep over water. Show me your endless measure of grace. Let tender mercies fall once again from your holy face. Deep in my soul, there's a craving to please the one who has saved me. Oh God, though I have fallen so far, you know that I'm still a man after your own heart. I can see and hear Danny singing that song right now. And I'm not here just to eulogize Danny for you today, but his life and his death provided a valuable lesson, multiple lessons really. But for today, this idea has been on my mind about being a person after God's own heart. That was his story. That was his song. That was who he was as a man, as a husband, as a father, a coach, a parishioner, a boss, a mentor, and a friend. What does it mean to be a man, to be a woman, to be a person after God's own heart? It's a perennial biblical phrase used a lot, quoted by Paul in the New Testament referring to King David, obviously who the Bible speaks of in that way, but it was coined by the judge and the prophet Samuel in the Old Testament. And we have that reading today. This is 1 Samuel 13, verses 5 through 14. And I did skip around a little bit. I think you have the text in front of you there on the screen, maybe not in your bulletin that I'm going to read. We pick up the story in midstream. King Saul is going out to battle. Samuel the prophet has told him, "Wait for me, I will come and offer sacrifices to God that he might bless you." So that's the context for the story. The Philistines, either one, mustered a mighty army of 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and as many warriors as the grains of sand on the seashore. Saul waited there 7 days for Samuel, as Samuel had instructed him earlier, but Samuel didn't come. Saul realized that his troops were rapidly slipping away. They're going AWOL on him. So he demanded, "Bring me the burnt offerings and the peace offerings." And Saul sacrificed the burnt offering himself. And like any good Hollywood script, just as Saul finished, Samuel arrived. Saul went out to meet him and welcome him, but Samuel said, "What is this you have done?" And Saul replied, "I saw my men scattering from me, and you didn't arrive when you said you would." Oh, I love this. "So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offerings myself before you came." Samuel answers, "How foolish. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God gave you. Had you kept it, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom must end. For the Lord has sought a man after his own heart." It's an ancient story, 1,000 years before the time of Jesus. Saul is the first king of Israel. It is a chaotic time. It is a violent time as this collection of loosely federated tribes attempts to become the cohesive kingdom of Israel. The kingdom is surrounded by competitors, by enemies. I'm sure it's not unlike what we read about today in places like Iraq or Afghanistan. We hear about Pashtuns and Uzbeks and Banu and Kurds and the Northern Alliance. It's an incredibly complex, multi-ethnic goulash, compounded by the fact that these tribes live in such close proximity to one another. That is the Israeli context in King Saul's day, except it's Hebrews and Amorites and Hittites and Phoenicians, and of course Israel's greatest ancient rival, the Philistines. Cast into this political, social, diplomatic, and militaristic cauldron, King Saul was simply not up to the task. His reign was a failure. And this story is provided as an example of his deficiencies in leadership, his lack of trust, his impulsiveness. And it is this link to the one who would follow him, the man after God's own heart. Again, what does this phrase mean? Well, there are a few ideas. The most common one in the Christian sphere is that there was something about David, whom the text is speaking of, and God that were alike. He was a man after God's own heart, as in God's heart and David's heart were similar. This makes David righteous, holy, altogether in sync with God and God's ways. And that is the predominant interpretation of this phrase in most churches. And I'll poke the tiger. This has never set well with me for a number of reasons. David was an arrogant piece of work sometimes. He could fly off the handle and extinguish a whole village, men, women, and children, if he got angry enough. He committed atrocities. He committed premeditated murder. He was an adulterer. He was a polygamist. And he so mismanaged his family that one of his sons raped his own sister in the king's palace. And his other son led an armed rebellion of insurrection against David, his father. We have to be careful here. When we say David is a man after God's own heart, of saying that David and God must be on the same page. For even as David gets to the end of his life and asks God to build God's house for him, "God, here I am living in a palace. I want to build a house for you, a temple for you." And God says to David, "You can't, because you have been a man of such bloodshed." So we get to maybe idea number two, an interpretation with deeper Jewish rabbinical roots. A man after God's own heart, the rabbis say, should be translated a man after God's choosing. A trivia question for you. Ready to play? Who chose King Saul as the first king of Israel? The people. The people. "We want a king," they cried out to Samuel, the judge and prophet. And Samuel said to them, "No, you don't. You know why? You get a king, you're going to be paying taxes. He's going to come get your sons and haul them off to war. He's going to make your daughters his servants. He's going to show up and take half your crops because he's got an administration to pay for. Everybody else has a king. We want a king. And God relents. And God says, give them what they want. So they get a king. And this is how the Bible describes Saul. Are you ready? Choice and handsome, without equal among the Israelites, a full head taller than any of his peers. And he was a failure. So this time, when it becomes apparent that good looks and physical abilities and the whole Men's Journal cover boy look isn't enough, God says, now it's my turn. You pick the first one. I'm going to pick the next one. Because God does things a little different. And so God does the opposite. He goes and picks a ruddy, skinny, guitar-playing, doe-eyed teenager named David. And that is a much stronger interpretation with the arc of Scripture. You pick and get what you get. Let me pick, and you'll get what you get. A few years ago, Philip Morrison, who is friends with Terry and Diane Olive, shared a story about going to a new doctor. He had relocated from Nashville, Tennessee to Austin, Texas, and he had to find a new doctor. He was moving closer to be with family. And the doctor looks at his records and says to him, I see you moved here from Nashville. I have a sister who lives in Nashville. Her name is Melissa Harris. And Philip says, well, that is so interesting because I have a cousin in Nashville who is named Melissa Harris. But you can't be related because we're not related. And the doctor says, huh. And he goes over and picks up his cell phone and goes to his Facebook app and pulls up a picture of his sister, Melissa Harris, and it is Philip's cousin. What? How did this happen? Here's how it happened. More than 50 years earlier, an unmarried teenage girl got pregnant, and as people did in those days, she was sent away to have the child. And afterwards, the baby, Melissa, was placed in adoption. The couple that would become her parents were called and told this, we have two babies that are available, come pick one. Can you imagine? So they go down to this hospital, and they're on the outside of this thick metal glass, metal-laced glass like they used to have in delivery rooms. And they're looking through this glass at these two babies. And the would-be father looks at Melissa and says, because she has this deep gash across her nose from the forceps when she was born. And the father looks at that little girl and says, that one with the scratched nose sure looks like she needs a little more help. That's the one we'll take home. And so they take her home. A few years later, she discovers that that teenage mother had returned to her life, had actually married the young man that was her biological father, and had three more daughters and a son. That son was the new doctor in Austin, Texas. And they had reunited just shortly before Philip makes that acquaintance. And Philip says like this, if you want to do something that's right, look for the baby girls with the scratches on their noses. She may need you to join with God in a beautiful chain of providential events that only God could orchestrate. And that's true. You want to know how God does things? Look at that story and look at David's story. We look at someone's physical abilities, their money, their influence, their charisma, their charm. If a person is defective in any way, we discount them, we reject them. But those who are limited, those who appear weak, those who appear like they might need some extra help, those are the very ones, it seems, that God says, I'm picking him or her to do my work. Saul looks like a movie character straight from central casting, like he belongs on a SEAL Team 6. Handsome as Leonardo DiCaprio, as dashing as Indiana Jones. And he's a miserable disappointment. David shows up a teenager, barely out of puberty, peach fuzz on his chin, a harp on his back like he's some traveling chorister, a slingshot on his hip like Huckleberry Finn, skinny and raw-boned, a pitiful physical specimen, and God looks at him and says, "That's the one. That's the one." Because everyone will know when he rises to power, it's because I did it and he didn't. You follow that? God doesn't look on outward appearances. God said to the prophet Samuel, "I look at the heart. I look what's on the inside." God looks at little girls with scratched noses, shepherd boys without a clue, football coaches who played as a player 50 pounds underweight but knew how to get up every time when they were knocked down. And that brings me to this third idea about this phrase, a man after God's own heart, and my friend Danny Durham. The phrase can also mean after, as in pursuit. A person who is after God's own heart is a person that is seeking God's heart, chasing the will of God. It speaks of one's direction, the trajectory of their life. Those after God's own heart aren't chasing or running selfishly after their own desires, their own egotistical goals. They are after what is pleasing to God. At Danny's funeral, one of his friends said, "There are two kinds of people in the world." This is so true. There are people that you run away from. You know those people. And there are people that you run to. Danny was the kind of person you ran to. And if I can just amend that a little bit more, not only was Danny a person that you ran to, the reason that you could run to him is because he was a man who was running after God. Even when he fell on that track, jogging as he did every day, running, his heart never to beat again, he was in pursuit of all that was good and just and right and holy. And those are the choices put to us. We chase after God's heart and God's will, or we chase, like a dog chasing its tail, after stuff that we will never actually capture. Those are the choices of life. Big Jim over here shared an article with me a couple weeks ago. Might have even been last week. From the recent column in the New York Times by Allison Arif, and it's titled, "Life is Short, That's the Point." She writes, and I'll give her the words here, because I sure can't improve on them. Quote, "Nearly all of the technological products that we buy and use today are designed to fail after a relatively short period of time. 1 year, 2 years, maybe 5, and if you've had to replace your smartphone lately, you know what I'm talking about. The irony, however, is that the same Silicon Valley culture that produces these gadgets seems to be obsessed with living forever. There is an actual company, Ambrosia Plasma, that provides teenagers' plasma infusions for $8,000 a liter. Google launched a biotech company called Calico to increase its, quote, understanding of the biology that controls lifespan. There are now people who refer to themselves as longevity entrepreneurs who see death not as a problem, but as something to be eliminated. But our time here is but a blip. And when we leave, the great world continues to spin. As such, the appreciation of our own lives has much to do with this ever-increasing awareness of its brevity. It is this, an awareness and acceptance of our own mortality that makes us human. And it is the impetus for living our lives to the fullest. It should leave us determined to seize, observe, and interact with what days that we have. It is the knowledge of how quickly, sometimes tragically, things can change or disappear that fuels our urgency to live for all that we are worth in the present moments that we have. And that is the challenge. If you live 9 years or 90, it is oh so short. There's one thing my children repeat back to me that I've told them many times, and I don't think they listen to most of what I say. But at least one thing has stuck because I've heard all three of them say it to me at some point, something my grandfather told me. And I've said it here, and I'll repeat it. He said, "Son, it took longer to get to 18 than it did to get from 18 to 80. No matter how long we live, it is short. And the choice is to live chasing things we can never catch and will never really matter, or live in pursuit of God's own heart and leave a legacy that can never be calculated." I'd like to offer the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson as our benediction, an acknowledgement to my friend Danny, and a challenge to the rest of us. Emerson said, "To laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics and to endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden path, or a redeemed social condition, to know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. That is to have succeeded."